This is one of the classes with more of a microscopic approach than, so we'll have to skim in places, but we'll slow down and take a close look. But first, let's give a general introduction to Pentateuch. It sometimes causes some confusion. That's the word for the first five books of the Bible. It's from the Greek. And the Greek simply means five volumes, or five books. That's why we call it that. You might wonder, why do we have these Greek names for books of the Old Testament if it was written in Hebrew and not Greek? And it's worth mentioning that the name comes from a famous translation of the Bible that was done during that intertestamental period I mentioned before. That translation was the Septuagint, it was called. The Septuagint refers to what's called the 70, where tradition says 70 scholars got together, and within 70 days they made a translation of the Bible from Hebrew into Greek. People debate whether they got it done in 70 days, because that would be an amazing feat. But the important thing to remember is that many of the references in the New Testament to the Old are quotations from the Septuagint, a Greek translation, and that explains. This is a side light, but sometimes you'll see a name a little bit different in the New Testament than in the Old, or a slight difference in the quotation. It's often because they're quoting a Greek translation of the Old Testament, and you know, translations sometimes word things slightly differently. But there are some other names that have been applied to what we're calling here the Pentateuch. One is the Torah, or in English we just say Torah. That means in Hebrew instruction, and it's sometimes translated as law. So often you'll see the Jews refer to the Torah. It means the first five books of the Bible. Sometimes in English we refer to the law or the book of the law in reference to those first five books. And just to give you a little more background, of course, I think you can easily look and see which ones they are. Of course, Genesis. The Greek for that, it means origins. The Hebrews had different names for these books, which I can let you know. This is, if you're playing Trivial Pursuit and you want to win, is where you use these. But it's worth knowing the Hebrew name for Genesis was Bereshith, Bereshith, which means beginnings. Often the Hebrew name was the first significant word in the book. And in Genesis 1:1, it says, in the beginning, God. So they call the book beginning. Similarly, Exodus. Exodus is from the Greek that means departure. As the source of our word exit, the Greek or the Hebrew name was Ve'elah, if I'm pronouncing it properly. And the Hebrew means names. Or these are the names. And that's Exodus. And we almost never refer to that name. We're happy with Exodus. But at the beginning of Exodus, you see, I want to look and make sure I'm telling you correctly. Yeah, now these are the names of the children of Israel. So I'm just showing you a trend there. Numbers, that's from the Greek that means, guess what? Counting, numbers. Oh, I skipped Leviticus. I knew something was wrong there. Let's squeeze in Leviticus. That's from the Greek means book of the Levites. And we'll explain that when we get there. The Hebrew, I love this, is Vayikra. And I'm not going to test you on these Hebrew names, so don't worry about that. But that means, and he called. And he called, the he being God, and we turn to the beginning of Leviticus, we see that. Yes, now the Lord called Moses. So basically the Hebrew name starting Leviticus was called. I mentioned numbers, the Greek means counting. Made a good English translation. The Hebrew name, they usually call it Bamidbar, which means wilderness, for from the wilderness. I can find the beginning of Numbers in my Bible. Yeah, now the Lord spoke to Moses from the wilderness. In Deuteronomy, of course, the Greek is from, the Greek means second law, which isn't referring to a second law, but a recounting of the law. Deuteronomy is a repetition of many things. The Hebrew, they called it Hadabarim, Hadabarim, which means words. At the beginning of Deuteronomy, sorry, I'm rushing through these. These are the words which the Moses spoke to all Israel. I think I heard somebody referencing a Disney movie earlier. Whenever I hear that words, I think of The Little Mermaid when Sebastian is singing Kiss the Girl. It's the strings, whatever it is, words. If you haven't seen it, you should go back. I'm not touting the movie, but I love the soundtrack. Okay, the Pentateuch, all five books, have been and are considered to be the work of Moses. And it's been considered to be that from antiquity to modern times. Jewish opinion has always been unanimous. They've always seen Moses as the author. And Jesus and the apostles all quoted from it, claiming it was Moses. And I've got a list of scriptures in my notes that I'm not going to spend the time, because just any place you see a reference to quotations from these books in the New Testament, they'll sometimes just say Moses said, or in the book of Moses. It's worth noting, and I'm talking about the Pentateuch in general, and we're going to quickly focus down to Genesis where we'll start, but you'll see throughout the Pentateuch sometimes passages or brief phrases or comments that seem like they must have been added after Moses wrote them. And most scholars believe that is probably the case. And that's sometimes simply a name. There'll be like the city of such and such, and then it might say, which formerly was called this, and you get the feeling that, okay, somebody added that to Moses' writing. The most common belief was that hundreds of years later, Ezra the scribe might have added some of those things, and they're all minor. It's not like Ezra comes and said, wow, that shouldn't be, I'm going to scribble that out and write something different. But we'll cover this when we cover the book of Ezra. Many scholars believe that Ezra probably canonized the Old Testament, which doesn't mean he loaded it in a canon and shot it out, but that he compiled the books that would be considered part of the Bible. And we believe that was under inspiration by God. Ezra was a master scribe, a great scholar, and if this is true, he got them together and got them in their final form, and he might have at times put what are sort of like marginal notes just to help modern people understand something that might have been written, you know, several thousand years earlier. And none of them are of significance to where, oh, if that's not true, it changes everything. But it's worth noting that. But aside from that, it's Moses' work. And I'm going to address something important about that as we go into Genesis. But let's say a couple more things about the Pentateuch in general. The Pentateuch is essentially an introduction to the rest of the Bible. You could say in it we find the origin stories. In it we find the basic laws. In it we find the beginnings of the national history of Israel. As I mentioned before, you know, if you have Old Testament and New Testament, the Old Testament deals primarily with that nation of Israel, and it gets its start here in the Pentateuch. Another thing I'll mention, I believe Mr. Myers, in introducing the epistles of Paul, discussed the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and we noted they had some differences in belief. One of the beliefs of the Sadducees was that only the Pentateuch was valid scripture. And that's why they didn't believe in angels or resurrection, because the Pentateuch doesn't really reference those things. Yes, Charlie? Thank you.
What about angels in the book of Genesis that dined with Abraham and also went to Sodom and was in Lot's house?
That's a very good question. What we'll note is they're described as men. And so the Sadducees might say, well, maybe one of these is the eternal God and the others were men. I'm not sure exactly what their explanations were, but there's no place where it calls them angels, except for the Garden of Eden and So again, I don't want to be contradicting myself. I'm not sure exactly how they derived that, but I know it was largely based on believing the Pentateuch was the Bible and the rest is good, you know, extra stuff. That's
so safe to say they didn't believe in the book of Joshua either.
I believe that's the case. Or they might have thought it was history but not inspired scripture.
Okay.
And I'm not an expert on the beliefs of the Sadducees. I just know that's a generalization of their belief. So I'm glad you pointed that out, because I generalized and there are details that I'm not sure how they reconciled. So I'm admitting my ignorance. Okay, other questions, because these are good points. And I want to make sure we use the microphones and comments, because we're hoping that this, our recording of Pentateuch this year might be put on the website eventually. So I want to try to make sure our comments are on there. So let's move to Genesis. As we do with most of the books, or all the books, we'll start with the five W's of Genesis. First one's pretty easy. Who? Who wrote the book? Well, I just spent a lot of time telling you, Moses. Moses is almost universally accepted as the author of the Pentateuch, and all of the Pentateuch and Genesis. There's something significantly different about Genesis, though. All the other four books he wrote pretty much as a first-hand account. He wasn't born yet before what's covered in Genesis finished. So Genesis obviously would be Moses writing from things he learned outside of his own experience. It seems even in places to include separate documents that he might have even copied almost entirely without altering. Now, maybe he drew on archives, or in some cases, maybe stories that were passed down. If you're open there, we're going to look at some of the things in Genesis. Let's note Genesis 2 and verse 4, just the opening phrase where it says, "This is the history of the heavens and the earth." If you have the old King James, is where there it would say, "This is the generations of the heaven and the earth." Skipping ahead to chapter 5, Genesis 5, verse 1, "This is the book of the genealogy of Adam." The King James there also has the book generations. I'll do just one more, although there are other examples. Chapter 6 and verse 9. Genesis 6, verse 9 says, "This is the genealogy of Noah." And again, the original, the 1611 King James said, "This is the generations of Noah." There's one Hebrew word that was used in all those scriptures. It's often pronounced toldah. And I've seen it spelled T-O-L-D-A-H, sometimes T-O-L-D-O-T-H. And the reason for the difference in spelling is, of course, they wrote it with Hebrew letters. So when we don't just translate, we transliterate, meaning we try to put it in our letters. And sometimes there's variations. But toldoth can mean a number of things. It can mean family or descent, as when it's translated generations. But it also seems to refer to a family history. So when we say this is the toldoth of something, it's like here's the story of this, is one good way to summarize it. And there are several places, at least 8, maybe even as many as 11, where it seems that Moses was taking an existing story, perhaps even a written document, and using that to help write Genesis. Sometimes perhaps even copying it almost in its entirety. And within one of the reasons we know that is often it's introduced with this word, like the three places I just read. Also, there seems to be a difference in style. So Moses has his own style, but sometimes we see, well, here's the story of Noah, and there's a story where the style is slightly different. And scholars of Hebrew say that's more noticeable if you're reading the original Hebrew. I was going to comment. We see that in early Genesis. We'll see a couple of different accounts of the creation of man. One in Genesis 1, and then in Genesis 2, suddenly we see a different account of the same event, and they differ. They don't contradict, they complement. And it seems that one is the story of the creation of everything, and now let me tell you the story about the creation of mankind, and it brings in some more details, you know, and it's a different account. Does that make sense? In some ways, it seems strange, but I'm bringing up some simple concepts that have big ideas that affect how we proceed. So I want to make sure, you know, we're clear on those things. But we're still on the five W's. So this is all the who. The who is Moses, but drawing on the works of other people, and we don't know who those other people were. Let's not discount that there might have been times where God said, Moses, let me tell you what happened, and you write it down. We know that's going to happen with the law and other things. We don't know but what God said, Moses, let me tell you what happened with Adam and Eve. So that's entirely possible, but he might have already known from some other sources. Which brings us to when. Okay, when did Moses write the Pentateuch? Well, the Pentateuch in general, he probably wrote while the children of Israel were wandering. And we'll get to that story later, but they wander for 40 years after they're led out of Egypt. And 40 years living in a tent wandering around could give you a lot of time to sit down and write some stories. And much of what's in the Pentateuch couldn't have been written sooner because it's about that wandering and about what happens at the end. But Genesis is a different case. Now, Genesis might well have been written during the 40 years wandering. And matter of fact, most scholars will say that it was, and I think that's very likely, but there's at least the possibility that it was written sooner. Because if you remember Moses' story, of course, he's born to a slave couple in Egypt, and at that time, Pharaoh has this policy of throwing the babies in the river, the baby boys, and killing them, but the mother keeps Moses until she can't hide him anymore, puts him in a basket in the river, and Pharaoh's daughter finds him. And she takes him and adopts him, and he's raised in Pharaoh's palace. And he becomes highly educated. There are stories outside the Bible of him becoming a scholar and a successful general and a leader in the government, which we don't know exactly if those are true or not. But I've sometimes wondered, during that 40 years before he decides to go work with the Israelites, if he's a scholar, he might have said, I want to write a history of the beginning of the world. He might have had access to documents. So it's possible, and I'm saying just possible, that Genesis might have been written while Moses was living in Pharaoh's court. Possibly. Let's consider something else. After Moses reveals himself to his people, he kills an Egyptian and runs for his life. He goes to the land of Midian, marries a girl there, and becomes a shepherd for 40 years. He might have written the book of Genesis during that 40 years. If he already had access to the knowledge and he thinks, I'm bored sitting here watching these sheep, I want a project to work on, he might have started writing Genesis. Notice I'm using the word might. We just don't know. We know he wrote it sometime, and unlike the other books, there's a possibility that Genesis might have been different. Yes, Charlie?
That would have been before God revealed himself in the burning bush on Mount Sinai.
Yes.
So he could have wrote Genesis before then, without inspiration?
Well, not necessarily without inspiration, but without the calling that he would have.
Okay.
And notice, I'll say, I like to present these as possibilities because I'd like to think of these things, but if I come down to it, I tend to side with the scholars that believe he probably wrote it while they were wandering in the wilderness. So the predominance of evidence supports that. I'm just putting out a perhaps for the others. And I like to do that. That's part of my teaching style. So I try to emphasize the might or perhaps or maybe when I do that. So note that's part of my style. And don't take it as Dr. Dunkel says this, and I think that's kind of weird. It might be kind of weird. I'm just, you know, I like us to encompass possibilities. Okay, so, and I've got in my notes, that speculation cannot be substantiated. You could see it as a possibility, but like I said, I couldn't prove it, and I wouldn't try to. Okay, now that does relate to the where. Where was Genesis written? Again, most likely in a tent that kept getting picked up and moved while they were wandering in the wilderness. That's the most likely answer. And again, that's still a relatively small area, and people debate how much of it was in the Sinai Peninsula and how much was actually over in the Arabian Peninsula. There's two schools of thought as to where the wandering happened, or some of both, and we don't have to know the answer to that. But if my speculation that he might have written it in Egypt is correct, then somewhere around here is a possibility, or over in the land of Midian, but most likely, like I said, leading the nation of Israel wandering in the wilderness. So the where is not very complicated. The next two questions are more complicated. Why? What was the purpose for the book of Genesis? Well, in some ways, it's not that complicated. It seems to be self-evident. Genesis preserves the origin stories, the stories of the beginning, the creation of the world, of the beginning of human civilization, and specifically the beginning of the family and then nation of Israel. And God wanted those stories preserved. You know, God wanted this preserved specifically for His people. I put in my notes, the book of Genesis provides important answers to many of the great questions of life. There are many great questions. Where did man come from? How did the world get this way? Who is God? A big part of those answers is there in Genesis. Now, later I've got a handout of a booklet that the church used to produce that says Answers from Genesis. I want to make copies and give you, but we'll cover it in the course of class. There's a specific reference I'll mention in Exodus 17, verse 14. In Exodus 17, 14, God was referring to something more specific, but it's a phrase that I think could apply to all of Genesis, where it says, "The Lord said to Moses, write this for a memorial in a book." So there is cases where we see God told Moses, write this down. And that was referring to something different, but I suspect Moses, and this works against my theory that he might have done it in Pharaoh's court, which Charlie pointed out, because you know it could be that Moses wrote Genesis because God wanted it written down and he inspired him. I would make the case it's possible that God inspired him before Moses knew it, but not likely. You know, possible, but not likely. Yeah, he had knowledge, yeah. And we know that he knew he was a Hebrew. Later on, he says he went to see his people. And it said he even thought that the account in Acts chapter 7, where Stephen the martyr is given this great sermon, he mentioned that Moses supposed his people would have understood that God would use him to deliver them. So we'll see that when we cover it. There's indication that when Moses first went, he thought, God's going to use me to free my people. Well, Moses' schedule was different than God's schedule. God was saying, yeah, I am, but not for 40 years. You got to learn some lessons first, Moses. We're getting off track there. So, yeah, we don't know how much Moses knew God before then. We know he didn't know God the way he would later know God. Later, he got to know God very well. Let's move to what. What is Genesis? And I'll remind you a lot of times my what and why overlap, but Genesis is the origin story. And I could stop there because it's the origin of the universe, the origin of mankind, the origin of sin, the origin of law, and it goes on. If we say the Pentateuch or the Torah is the law, and I said that's an introduction to the Bible, we could say Genesis is an introduction to the rest of the Pentateuch. Especially the early part, because everything that follows is, you know, you have to have Genesis first. And I made the point earlier that in some places it seems to incorporate perhaps some different documents into one, where you have a toldoth of something else that Moses included. Oh, yeah. I'd like to note this because it's the first book of the law. It doesn't have much law in it. And that's one of the reasons I like Genesis. Genesis is mostly narrative. And I'm a historian. I like narrative. I like stories. Genesis is great for that. Matter of fact, I'll tell you sort of a personal story. When I was in the eighth grade in my English class, we had to do a book report. And I wasn't trying to be a smart aleck. I wrote a book report on the book of Genesis. My teacher wasn't impressed. She gave me a C. But I still think it was a pretty decent book report. Genesis has two main sections, okay? Section 1 is chapter 1 through chapter 11. So the first, and so they're not equal sections, because the second section is chapter 12 through chapter 50. So the second section is a lot bigger, but as I'll discuss soon, the first section covers a lot more ground and a lot more time period. The first section, 1 through 11, is the general history of the origin of the world, the origin of mankind, the origin of human civilization. All that's in just 11 chapters. Genesis 12 through 50 now starts, it has the story of Abraham and the story of his descendants, and very specifically, in most cases, the story of that family's relationship with God. So it's not just, let me tell you everything about Abraham and everything about Isaac and everything about Jacob. It focuses on how they related to God and what God was doing with them and then their descendants. So actually, that relates very well to something I'm going to get to, but another thing, I want to say this with caution. So don't jump to a conclusion when I say this about the first section of Genesis. It can be called the creation myth. But when I say that, I don't mean fiction. Not at all fiction. It's the true inspired word of God. When I say creation myth, I'm referring to a style of writing. I could also call it the creation epic, and that doesn't create the alarm bells when I say the word myth. But I wanted to give the idea that it's a special style of writing that's somewhat poetic, somewhat broad-reaching. It's not intended to be a scientific description. We can compare it to science and get some good observations, but it's not the way a scientist would write the first week of creation by any means. It's not a legal thesis. And we're going to see law described and such, but the creation epic is not written in that style. Okay? For one thing, it tells us what God wants to say, and it leaves a lot of things not said. And that's evident if you read it, but I'm going to focus on that. As a matter of fact, to help us understand that, I want to introduce a term that comes, it's common in what we call oral history. Oral history is where you go and interview people and they tell their story, and sometimes you make a written account from that. The term is velocity of narrative. And this isn't a Bible term, but it's a term that might help us understand what happens, especially in Genesis. Velocity of narrative is referring to how much data is given relative to the chronology or the period of time covered. How much do I talk about something that happened in a certain amount of time? Let me give you an example that might make it clear. If you're telling someone your life story, say Kayla is saying, you know, from Minnesota, you might cover the first 15 years of your life in a sentence or two. And then things get interesting. You're getting ready to finish high school and go to college, and you slow down and spend several sentences. You know, and then, you know, as say you're many years older, I picked on you, you don't have that much of a life, but, you know, you might say, okay, I decided to come to Ambassador College. Say at some point in time you meet someone you want to marry and you build a family, and you spend some time, and then suddenly I got in a career and zoop, I rush across 20 years. I was a successful public accountant, you know, and such, and then some event happened, and I'm going to spend a minute or two telling you about that one event. Do you see what I mean by velocity of narrative? And you'll all do that when you give your icebreaker speeches. You heard it yesterday. You know, I tried to cram 50-some years into 5 or 6 minutes, and it doesn't work very well. So velocity of narrative is important in Genesis. And also another important thing about writing history. This applies to any history. And it's the idea of, you could use the term selectivity. And there's probably a technical term that I don't remember, but in general, if I'm writing a history of something, who decides what's in that history? No, I do. I decide some things are important enough to say or write, and some things are not. My focus as a historian was on late colonial revolutionary America, so I might want to write a history of George Washington's life. Can I tell you everything that happened in his life? And I'll say this, when I started studying history, I was disappointed, and I had to change my thinking of what the word history meant. Because to me, history is everything that's happened. And then I learned, no, history is somebody's account of what happened. So the history, it doesn't become history, everything that happened is simply everything that happened. But a history of the world is somebody's story about what happened, and guess what? It's not going to include everything. my history of George Washington, for it to be everything, would have to include what time the sun rose and set every day, what he ate for lunch, what was his body temperature from minute to minute. I mean, do you see how silly that can get? What did he feed his cat for lunch? I'm not going to write about George Washington's cat. I don't even know if he had a cat. But when he became a surveyor and traveled west, I'm going to talk about that. That affected who he was. And when he became an officer in the Virginia militia and led a group of troops against the French in around what is now Pittsburgh, I'll write about that. And I won't talk about what color shirt he was wearing. Okay, so this idea of selectivity applies in the book of Genesis, along with velocity of narrative. God decided what to include and what not to include. Sometimes that's very frustrating because you know who I want to decide what to include and not to include? I want me to decide. I got questions I want answered that aren't answered here. It's frustrating sometimes. And we'll all go through that together, and that's why we have this speculation. When and where did Moses write Genesis? I'd love to know for certain, but I speculate because it doesn't tell us for certain. Think of the velocity of narrative here. Genesis 1 through 11 covers about 2,000 years of history. Okay. Chapter 1 covers pretty much 1 week of those 2,000 years. Chapter 3 covers about a year or two, you know, relating to Noah's flood. So we could say, really, we've got about 7 chapters covering about 2,000 years of human history. Okay, what's not covered? An awful lot is not said in there. And it leaves us to speculate and guess. Matter of fact, many of you, are you familiar with the term gap theory? We'll discuss that probably pretty soon. The gap theory is the idea that between Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, and chapter 1, verse 2, there's a gap of time. If the gap theory is correct, those two verses cover perhaps billions of years in just two verses. And then Genesis 1:3 through chapter 2:3 covers 1 week. Then we speed up again. Genesis 4 verses 1 through 4 probably covers several decades. So what I'm getting at is as we go through especially the early chapters of Genesis, the velocity of narrative speeds up. Slows down, speeds up, slows down. And that's not a problem. We just need to be aware. And sometimes, and I'll point these out, I've been guilty of this as much as anyone. In the past, I've read something and made an assumption because I didn't think of the velocity, and that assumption isn't necessarily correct. And I'll get to some of those fairly quickly, so I won't bog down and mention them now. And when I'm discussing all of this, one of the points I want to make, this should not make us doubt Genesis. As I said, I believe, I'm convinced down to my toes that Genesis is the inspired word of God. I believe it's true. But we should realize that the book of Genesis is what God intended it to be, and it's not necessarily what I might want it to be or wish it was at certain times. And I love the book of Genesis. I'm not saying I wish it were different. But there are times when I want something out of it that's not there. It can, you know, sometimes it's a lot of fun to be able to speculate and guess about things. And again, I think part of the fun of being a scholar of the Bible, which all of you guys can call yourselves scholars of the Bible, whether you like it or not, is you get to discuss and debate and, you know, consider things like that. Questions or thoughts? I'm about to plunge into chapter 1, verse 1. In a lot of our classes, we spend all this time talking about the book before we get into the book. There's a lot in this. Matter of fact, this is one of the most important chapters in all the Bible, but it's not one that we're unfamiliar with. But we want to, actually, I'm going to erase this because we want to look at some of the Hebrew words while we're going through. How many people could probably think they could say what Genesis 1:1 says without looking? Yeah. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Okay, there's several things in there we want to consider. One is that word in the beginning could and probably should be properly translated in a beginning. And Hebrew participle, is it participles or what's the other word? No? Articles, thank you, articles. Hebrew articles can be vague just like English articles can be vague. Sometimes the or a, sometimes they matter a lot, but they can be vague. There's another place in the Bible where it says something very similar. John 1, verse 1, also says, in the beginning. It doesn't say created the heavens and the earth. John 1, 1 says, in the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God and the Word was God. And that's vital to our understanding of God's nature. And this class isn't about God's nature. But it does tell us why the word here for God is plural. But we believe John 1:1 happened well before Genesis 1:1. So if you want to say, where's the real beginning of the Bible? John 1:1. And then there's some other hints in places of the Bible of some things that happened. And we get to Genesis 1:1. God created the heavens and the earth. The word there for God is Elohim, which means it is a plural word. Literally, it means strong ones or mighty ones. And it could be translated gods. One of the reasons it's not is it is a plural word. The singular could be written either as El or it's often Eloah. That would mean singular. And you see that in some places in the Bible, although not very often. I'm pointing this out. There are some places where the Hebrew Elohim is used in the Old Testament that's not referring to God. Not very many. It's very seldom, but there are some from the context. It's referring to like princes or powerful human beings. Most often, the context makes it obvious. It's talking about God. No, but it's gods. And by the way, see, this is singular. In Hebrew, I am makes a word plural. Think in English, how do we make a word plural? Usually we add an S. I am is the Hebrew version of adding an S. And like English, I think there are some words where they do something different. Like, we don't add an S to sheep to make it plural, which is really frustrating when you say sheep. Yes, Charlie?
About the name Elohim, can that imply family?
Yes.
As in the family nature of
God?
It
certainly can.
Okay.
Now, we've gone further than the actual grammar implies before. We used to use the term uniplural word, and it can mean that. Like, we use words like team. A team is singular and has several members. Okay, that's accurate, and this can mean we talk about the God family, which I'll talk about. But I just want to say, grammatically, this is a plural word. So it's not team as a singular word, but it's something you know is made up of several parts. This is a plural word, but all through here, it has singular verbs. And in English, sometimes you have to have a different case of the verb for singular than plural, and sometimes not. But in the Hebrew, the distinction is clear. And so it's used as though it were a singular word. And the reason for that is it's referring to the God family. And again, I'm not making this into a lecture about the nature of God, but it's worth us realizing. And to talk about, actually created, that's a plural noun. In the beginning, God created, plural noun, or I'm sorry, I said it backwards, singular noun. So the plural noun with a singular verb, as though it's one. If you look at Genesis 3:22, just a page or so over, just to make sure you understand, it's not a mistake, it's plural. And we see the plurality undeniable. He says, the Lord God said, behold, the man has become like one of us. One of us means there's more than one, right? Okay, and the us here is Elohim. And our understanding of what that means comes from John 1:1. In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. We've often use the explanation that I think helps to make it clear is God in John 1:1 could refer to a family name. You know, like there's the father and the son. Like if I bring my son Connor in, hey, this guy's Dunkel. He's with me, I'm also Dunkel. You know, and we're both Dunkel, but there's two of us, but we have the same name. God the Father and the one who would become God the Son, that applies to them. And this probably is not new to any of you, I hope. But it's something that many churches don't teach or understand or believe. Oh, well, I will mention also, in English, we have a singular word, God. It comes from the ancient Anglo-Saxon. It's related to the word good. That's something in my study I'd always wondered about that. It comes from the ancient, God is the good one. And so it developed linguistically or etymologically into God is the good one, the good being. The Greek was theos. And so where you see God in the New Testament, it's usually from theos. In the Old Testament, God is almost always from Elohim. Okay, so we haven't got through the whole verse yet because I want to say something about created. The word created here is from the Hebrew bara, B-A-R-A-H. God bara the heavens and the earth. I'm making the distinction because that really means he made something from nothing. It doesn't mean that he organized the heavens and the earth, that he took existing matter and set it up. It means he made it in the first place. So he made it from nothing. Or you could say from, from his spirit. Somehow he made, I think of E equals MC squared, and I wonder, is that somehow related? But spirit is not E. It's beyond our physical understanding, I believe. But, and here's a reference I had earlier. In that gap between, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and he created, if you look at Job 38, verse 7, we'll see a reference to something it's worth noting. Job 38, 7 is a sort of a reference to this event. Yeah, I should back up, because in verse 4 of Job 38 it says, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth?" Laid the foundations of the earth could be a poetic way of saying, I created the earth. And God is talking to Job, saying, where were you when I did this? I created the earth. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know who stretched this line upon it. To what were its foundations fastened, and who laid its cornerstone? He goes on through all this, and we want to make note in verse 7, when the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy. If this is referring to God creating the heavens and the earth, there's somebody there singing and shouting for joy. Somebody that's referred to as morning stars and sons of God. It's almost, most everyone agrees that's referring to angels, created spirit beings. And what we'll see, I'll reference this when we go through chronology, it seems that before God created the physical heavens and earth, he had created angels. And they got to see him create the physical, and they were fired up about it. They're singing for joy and shouting. They're thrilled. Hey, you did a great job, God. We love this. How many of them were there? I have no idea. Did he create others after that time? Also have no idea. There's not a Bible reference to that. So it's one of those questions we don't know. And matter of fact, Genesis doesn't tell us about the creation of angels. I just had to look to the book of Job to find a reference. But it's worth us noting, it seems that they were there, and that'll give us some hint as to some of what happened during that gap, perhaps. Because we're about to go into that gap. But I want to mention one other thing. The heavens and the earth, heavens is a plural word properly. It's shemayim, S-H-E-M-A-Y-I-M. So you get that I-M. Okay, so it's plural heavens. How many heavens are there, do you think? Okay, we have the word three. Why do we say three? There is a reason. Okay, so you're referring to our atmosphere, we could call the heavens, and that's a common usage. Okay, outer space, we could refer to a heaven. Okay, where God lives, we consider that to be heaven. Yeah, Kayla?
Did somebody in the New Testament say they were in the third heaven?
Yes, that's where I'm going. Ding, ding, ding. I wish I had the bell. 2 Corinthians 12, verse 2. 2 Corinthians 12, 2, Paul refers to being caught up to the third heaven. And I want to make the point, we've counted down and say, well, if where God is the third heaven, that's a good idea. Well, there seem to be three. What are the other two? And then we say, well, the atmosphere is a heaven. Outer space seems to be a different heaven. Is there a fourth heaven? Not that I know of, but I couldn't disprove it. So we say at least three, and there's no reason to think there need to be more, but plural is appropriate. And they're there from the beginning. In the beginning, God created the heavens, plural, and the earth, only one earth. Okay, we've covered one verse. We'll speed up. I told you velocity of narrative applies to this class, too. Okay, now let's move. There's a gap, because then we see, and the earth was without form and void. Let's note that that word was is the Hebrew hayah, H-A-Y-A-H, not X. H-A-Y-A-H. I'm not sure of the pronunciation hayah. I want to say hayah and do my karate, but it's probably not that. The reason I'm mentioning hayah can be was, but it's also correct to be translated as became. And I believe very much that that would be the correct translation. The earth became without form and void. And there's reasons for that. There is another place nearby where the same Hebrew word is used. Over in Genesis 4 and verse 2, we're going to see Cain and Abel are born. In Genesis 4, 2, it says, she, meaning Eve, bore again, this time his brother Abel. Now, Abel was Abel Hayah, a keeper of sheep. Was Abel born a keeper of sheep? Did he come out with a shepherd's crook and leading sheep right out of the womb? No. He grew up, learned, and became a shepherd. And I'm just making that case. Yes, the word hayah can mean became. It is proper for it to mean that. And the grammatical usage we see right here in Genesis supports that. We also see something else, because it became without form and void. Anybody remember what without form and void is translated from? A couple of famous Hebrew words. Tohu and bohu. Tohu and bohu can mean without form and void, often translated confusion and chaos, or confusion and emptiness. I want to turn to Isaiah 45, verse 18, for something important that God says. Isaiah 45, 18. There we go. Thus says the Eternal, who created the heavens, who is God, who formed the earth and made it. Oh, we're talking about God created the heavens and the earth. Here he's saying, yeah, I'm the God who did that. I created the heavens, I formed the earth, who has established it, who did not create it in vain. Well, it says here in Genesis 1, 2, it became without form and void, tohu and bohu. Here in Genesis or Isaiah 45, 18, the word that's translated vain is tohu. And he says, I didn't make it tohu. I didn't create it tohu, but it became tohu and bohu. Which tells me what? I didn't make it that way, it became that way. What's in between Genesis 1, 1 and 1, 2? Something happened. That's exactly how. We don't know exactly, we can speculate, but something happened. It became that way. Yes, Emily.
I was just wondering if there was any other like examples where was the hayah is translated as became. Or is it always translated as was?
You know, I don't have any written down. I think there are, but I don't have it in my head yet. Jan?
Does it work? Okay, so normally you'd need the preposition for the verb in order to be translated as to become.
Ah.
As we see in Genesis, it can sometimes be translated to become without the preposition, but only in rare cases.
Right. And does the German make a distinction that would matter?
Yes.
Because I know different translations sometimes. Some people in another language said, well, that was never even an issue in our translation.
Oh, no, it has two different. There are two different verbs in German.
Okay. So, yeah, and so Emily, my short answer is I'm not sure. But that's one of the reasons, though, I don't base what I'm saying only on the grammar, how it's translated. But going to Isaiah, to me, that's pretty conclusive. I didn't make it that way. It became this way. So something happened to make it become that way. And we'll discuss that another time. But our common teaching is that it's what we is commonly called Satan's rebellion or Lucifer's rebellion. And it caused great destruction. Okay, so this is where what we commonly refer to as the gap theory. And we don't know how long a time it was, but since, you know, scientists and archaeologists and geologists say the Earth is like 4 billion years old, and we've only got recorded history going back 6,000, our thought is that gap is pretty big. We can't prove that. And we can't prove that the gap theory really happened, but I think the Bible supports it much more than it supports the young Earth theory. Yeah, Charlie?
Is it possible scientists say that the world's billions of years old to hide behind their Big Bang theory and evolutionary thinking?
That's possible, yeah. There, matter of fact, if you get a chance, if you're not from here, there's a creation museum near here, and the people that built it also built a reproduction of the Ark. And they have exhibitions. They believe in a young Earth. And so they have a lot of arguments explaining why they believe the Earth could only be 6,000 years old. And so they'll say a lot of scientists are hiding or disguising things or making claims that aren't substantiated. I think their arguments are really strong to disprove the theory of evolution. They don't argue why the gap theory couldn't be correct, and I'm not sure why that is, and I don't want to engage in an argument with them. We've had students in this room who fervently believed in a young Earth. Okay, and my position is always, I don't have to prove it one way or the other. You know, it could be a young Earth and it might not be. You know, as I said, I think there are scientific reasons and I think things in the Bible that support the gap theory. But if that's not true, when Christ said, you know, the lawyer asked Christ, what do I have to do to have eternal life? Keep the commandments, not know how old the Earth is. So, like I said, I try to show why the United Church of God teaches one way, not the other. But we don't get hung up on it or think that, you know, you're not a Christian if you believe that. So, Charlie, you're safe. Don't worry.
Whenever there is uncertainty, let us go back to Deuteronomy 29:29.
Deuteronomy
29 and 29.
Okay, what do you have there? Deuteronomy 29:29.
The secrets.
Oh.
Secret things belong unto Yahweh.
Yes, yes. Very, very good put. The secret things belong to the Lord our God. Those things revealed belong to us and our children. And yeah, what happened, if there is a gap or not between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2, is a secret that belongs to God. As I said, I've got a feeling that I think I know some, but that's okay. Like I said, I'm ready to acknowledge I could be wrong on some things. So let's take 10 minutes.